This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. You want conspiracies? How about this? Seattle violating the constitutional rights of American citizens on property. How about trade with Korea? We'll talk about that as well. Not the North, the South, although someday if they kind of came to their senses, we might be able to do that. How about who gets to choose which tenant you put in your housing? But I wanted to start today with John Kitzhaber, the disgraced former governor of Oregon, and the latest development in that long and strange saga of John Kitzhaber, who had to resign a month after he took the oath of office for what would have been his fourth term in office that he did not deserve, and his girlfriend. I know, they once called her the First Lady of Oregon. He apparently still calls her the First Lady of Oregon. She's still out selling TED Talks and other advice and consultation, portraying herself as the former First Lady of Oregon. She never was. She never was married to John Kitzhaber. And if you had to ask me right now, do I think they'll ever get married? I don't know. When John finds gainful employment and they get out of the morass of fines and penalties, I mean, she just got hit, as I told you yesterday, with a $125,000 lien against a house that you can pretty well guess she probably doesn't have $125,000 in equity in. But Kitzhaber, this guy got a sweetheart deal. And I think this is dead wrong. John Kitzhaber violated state ethics laws. I don't think he knew anything about ethics because the report that came out on Valentine's Day this year, which has now produced his deal that he's made as of yesterday, he violated conflict of interest laws 7 times. He violated a law prohibiting the use of a public office for private gain 3 different times. He violated a law limiting gifts to public officials to $50 one time. What did he get? Well, his girlfriend earned close to $250,000 in consulting fees because she was running her business out of the governor's office, and she was using her position, I think, to persuade various private interest groups, I've got the governor's ear. I can tell the governor what positions to take on certain issues. And as a result, she scored almost $250,000 in contracts. And what is John Kitzhaber going to have to pay for being part of a couple that earned almost $250,000, 20 grand. The actual potential penalty was 50 grand, and I think they should have thrown the book at him. If Oregon wanted to send a message that it believes in enforcing ethics laws, they would have said, you are subject to $50,000 in penalties. You're going to pay every single dime. Do you know what they did instead? He gets a 60% discount, better than a BOGO. I mean, a buy one, get one, he's getting more than half off. He is only going to have to pay $20,000. Now, I'll tell you what, if you're a criminal and he hasn't been accused of a crime, he isn't being indicted for a crime, he hasn't been in front of a jury or a judge, but I think what he did violated state law. So does the Ethics Commission believe he violated state law. Why in the world would you give him 60% in reduction off the fines that he should have paid? If somebody illegally obtains $250,000 in benefits by having the benefits come to his girlfriend and they share a household and they shared expenses, we know that from the emails that Sylvia Hayes tried to hide. If you get $250,000 and you got to flip 20 grand to the state of Oregon, well, that's a pretty sweetheart deal. That's like a tip. It's a 10% tip that you're throwing off. I would imagine that if you are feloniously inclined, you might say, I get $250,000 and all I have to pay in fines is 20 grand. That's a sweet deal. I understand he's no longer governor at all, but he's still getting a PERS pension, 40 or 50 grand a month, a year, 40 or 50 grand a year. Again, he was originally, they were going to give him the sweetheart deal of all sweetheart deals. Last November, the Ethics Commission staff, and I think they ought to get fired for this, they told the ethics board, the folks who actually vote on it, they said, let's let Kitzhaber off for $1,000. $1,000. They were going to take the potential penalties from $50,000 down to $1,000. I mean, for John Kitzhaber, it'd be like paying a parking ticket. Thank God the Ethics Commission said, we are not buying that deal. And if it was your staff, if they were working for you, I want you to think about if you were sitting on the Ethics Commission board and the staff said, let him off for $1,000. When he's up for $50,000 in fines for disgracing the job that he held for spitting in the face of the voters, would you let those people continue to advise you if they advised you, yeah, let him off for almost nothing? I don't think so. Doesn't work for me. Anyway, glad to have you with me. Welcome to the program. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I'm glad to take your calls. And naysayers, too. Anybody want to defend Sylvia Hayes or John Kitzhaber? I'd be glad to hear the argument at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can email to talk at LarsLarson.com. Follow me on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show. And this one has to do with Seattle. Should landlords be able to choose which tenants will live in their properties? The city of Seattle, and I'm going to tell you more about this in just a moment, the city of Seattle tried to pull a deal where they said, if you're a landlord and somebody walks in and says, I want to rent, you have to take the first person who walks in the door. That is unconstitutional. I'll get into that in just a moment. But we're asking it in the Twitter poll today as well. Should a landlord, you, the property owner, the person who owns private property, which is such a rare and in some parts of the world unique thing, but in America without private property ownership, we don't have much of anything. Should landlords be able to choose which tenants live in their properties or rent their properties? You can answer the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show or on the website LarsLarson.com. It is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right. Online at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's get started with some nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
When it comes to violent crime, will politicians let police do their jobs or tie them down with political correctness? A new audit of Portland police questions why so many black citizens get stopped by the police in high crime neighborhoods. Now, the answer seems kind of obvious to me and maybe to you, but let's walk through it anyway. Gangs commit a lot of the drug and violent crimes in American cities. Black suspects make up a majority of gang members, check the numbers, and a lot of black Americans get hurt by that crime. So police focus on high crime neighborhoods, and they use traffic stops to go after those suspects, and that leads to a lot of stops of black motorists, and of course, not all of them are gang members. That's not profiling any more than the fact that 75% of convicted criminals are men. So cops stop more men than women, even though you outnumber us 51 to 49. Frankly, I don't see how the police are supposed to stop crime without focusing on the place where it happens. Police Chief Danielle Outlaw of Portland says she wants better documentation of who and where and when and why police make traffic stops. I guess that includes race and gender, too. More paperwork for the cops means less policing, as far as I'm concerned. And imagine that poor officer who sees near the end of the month that she is short on white stops and long on black stops. And she decides she has to fill that quota. And now the grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Today's Daily Grill, I award to Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler for proposing. And if you're worried about the national debt at now $21 trillion, you ought to worry about your local debt as well. The debt's being run up by cities and counties and the states of the Pacific Northwest. Ted Wheeler is now proposing two-thirds of $1 billion in borrowing for a whole bunch of pet projects, $600 million to be paid back, as the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper accurately puts it, quote, with money the city does not yet have. You're going to borrow and you have no idea how you're going to pay it back? I can't wait till the next time that Mayor Ted Wheeler agrees to grace us with his presence and do an interview. His staff keeps promising he's going to do that. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, comes from Ron Reese, U.S. Marine Corps combat veteran, and thank you for your service. Lars, Would you remind folks that today, 3/29, is Vietnam Veterans Day recognition? It seems like all the other major local news is ignorant of this. It's a big deal to us Viet vets as we sacrificed and bled too for our country, only to be spit on, called names, baby killer. Yeah, baby killer. That was our thanks for serving proudly back then. No parades, no flag waving, only middle fingers. To have the president set aside a day for us and not even mention the painful memories of combat, Kaysan and Tet, never go away, nor does the hurt of being ignored still by your country's politicians and media. Some things never change. Welcome home to all my brothers and sisters who proudly served our country at a time it was not popular to wear the uniform of military service. At the very least, we remember each other. God bless our United States of America. Signed, Ron Reese, U.S. Marine Corps Combat Marine. Back in just a moment, and we are going to talk about that unconstitutional move the city of Seattle tried that has now been struck down, believe it or not, by a King County judge of all things. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to tell you something. I think that private property rights are one of the most important things we have. In fact, all of those other rights and freedoms that Americans enjoy, God-given and allegedly protected by the Constitution, they don't mean much of anything at all if you can't own private property. And I'm not only talking about real estate. I'm talking about the ability to buy things and sell things. That is commerce. Without commerce, you can't start a business. In fact, without commerce, a lot of us would not have jobs. And yet there was the city of Seattle saying, we are going to decide for you that if you're a landlord, that you put an apartment house or a house up for rent, and you have to take the first person who walks through the door. Doesn't matter if they walk in the door, you have to take them as a tenant. And I thought that was outrageous at the time they did it. And apparently a King County judge agrees with me who has struck down a Seattle law designed to limit housing discrimination. Well, that's allegedly what it was about. The two-year-old law requires landlords to rent to the very first qualified applicant. You do not get a chance to choose who you're going to rent to. Now, the renter can choose. I've looked at 50 apartments. I'm going to choose this one. So the tenant gets all the choice. The landlord gets no choice. I don't think that's right. Ethan Blevins joins me now, who's with the Pacific Legal Foundation, an attorney on the case. Ethan, welcome back to the program, and tell us how we got this remarkable result from a King County judge.
Sure. Thanks, Lars. Well, I think, first of all, it's a sign of how far Seattle has gone, and that eventually, even in a fairly liberal place like King County, a judge is not willing to go quite as far as the city has in denying people's basic property rights.
Now, the judge, it's a young lady judge, Suzanne Parisian, I believe the way you pronounce her name, calls the law unduly oppressive. Did she expand on that at all?
Sure. So we brought four different claims. We brought a basic takings claim, we brought a due process claim, and a couple others. And she was referring to due process. She gave us a victory on all four of our constitutional theories. And when she said it's unduly oppressive, what she meant is that this law imposes this really burdensome requirement on all landlords without any evidence that these individuals are actually discriminating.
Because that's what they were aiming at. They were saying that I'm going to speak to their thinking, and you tell me if you think I'm right or not. The folks in city government, at least in the city of Seattle, and I think probably some other liberal cities, looked at landlords and said, you folks are just a bunch of unabashed bigots, aren't you? So when somebody walks in to rent your apartment, if it's a person of color, if it's somebody who's gay, if it's somebody who's physically disabled, you landlords are just such bigoted individuals. We'll just assume all of you are going to discriminate against all these deserving renters, and you're going to pick somebody based on skin color, based on gender, based on sexual preference or whatever. And so we're going to convict you all. We're going to make you all guilty. And so because you're all guilty, you all get sentenced to this. You don't have any choice about who you rent to. Was that the thinking?
Right. I mean, it essentially presumes guilt. The city said, hey, first of all, it's kind of hard for us to do our jobs and enforce intentional discrimination. So we should be able to just assume it. And because you might implicitly or unconsciously be biased, even if you don't know it, we think we should be able to just take away your choice entirely.
Ethan Blevins is an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, which frequently goes to bat on cases like this. So tell me this. When they talk about unconscious bias, do you buy that theory that somebody could could be biased against somebody and not even know they're being biased, and then evidence that bias by refusing to rent to them? Because most of the landlords I know are decent people, and the only color they care about is whether your money is green or not. If you pay the rent, they're happy with you.
I think that's definitely generally true. And another aspect of this is the city assumes that the only reason you'd choose a tenant would be a bad reason. Choose your own tenant is a bad reason. But plenty of landlords have goodwill. They want to help people out. They want to be responsible landlords. And we have some of our clients intentionally reached out to and rented their property to minorities who needed a break because they wanted to be a good citizen. And the city entirely ignores that element of choice, that people use their choice to do good things all the time, not just bad things.
All right, so Ethan, tell me this. Where does it go? We got about a minute left, but is the city going to appeal this thing up the chain to the appeals courts?
I'd be surprised if they didn't appeal. We haven't had word on that yet, but I think that they really invested a lot of energy in this. They really believe heartily in it, and I'd be surprised if they let it go.
All right, so the practical question then is, while it's being appealed, does the law stay in force, or is the law now thrown out based on Judge Parisian's decision?
Well, she granted our request for injunctive relief. She hasn't issued a final order to that effect, but in effect, the law is null and void until it gets overturned on appeal, which I don't think the city has the chance to overturn a decision that gave us a victory on four separate grounds.
And I'm guessing if they appeal, Pacific Legal Foundation will be there to fight.
Oh, yes. We'll take it all the way up as far as it needs to go.
Very good. Ethan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for the work you do at the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Thank you so much.
You betcha. Now, can you imagine this? A government, even a local government, like a city government, saying to you, you own your property. You pay the taxes on it. You pay the mortgage on it. You pay all the other things. You're liable. If somebody slips and falls on your property, it's your fault and you have to pay. But when it comes to deciding how you get to rent your property to a willing tenant, that's not your decision anymore. That is absolute lunacy. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Well, here we are in the Pacific Coast, and we do a lot of trade with Asia. That's the bottom line. We do a lot of trade. Now, I know that some of you think America's out of the trade business. 12% of our entire GDP comes from trade. And if we weren't trading with Asia, we would have a problem. But if we weren't buying things from them and selling things to them, we would have a major problem. So trade with Asia is very, very important. And yet, Donald Trump has said, if you're not going to trade with us fairly, you're going to be subject to some pretty harsh penalties in the form of tariffs. And I know all the supposedly smart folks said, no, that can't work. That's not the right way to do it. That's not how we do things. Well, he did it a different way. And now it looks like we've got some better trade conditions with places like South Korea. Peter Navarro joins me now, assistant to the president of the United States and the director of trade and industrial policy for the White House. Peter, good to have you back on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Lars, my friend, we haven't talked since the campaign back in November, but it's good to be with you again.
It's great to have you on the program. So tell me how this is going to work out. Is this South Korean trade deal good news for America?
It's more than that. It's great news for America, and it works on a number of levels. First, just boots on the ground. We are about to enter a serious negotiation led by President Trump with respect to North Korea nuclear proliferation. And what we've done with this agreement with South Korea is basically strengthen our economic ties by removing a serious friction point. At the same time, we've strengthened our national security relationship with South Korea. So that's number one. Number two, this is indeed an historic event. We've never really ever renegotiated a trade deal. That seems astonishing, but this is an achievement. And what's interesting about this is we basically got the three top worst trade deals in American history are China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2001, the NAFTA Accord, which was signed in 1994, both of those caused literally millions of jobs to go offshore. But pound for pound, the 2012 Hillary Clinton-Barack Obama Korea deal really is one of the worst ones in terms of magnitude, because within 4 short years, we doubled our trade deficit in goods with South Korea. We did it in a way where we didn't sell effectively a single dollar more of exports. In other words, the only thing that happened is we imported a bunch more. And finally, the imports were primarily autos and auto parts, so they really struck a strong blow to our manufacturing economy. So Canada Trump, during 2016, repeatedly promised that he would either end that deal with Korea or he would renegotiate it. And lo and behold, he's kept that promise. And what's interesting to me, being at the White House watching this whole process unfold over many months, is the president was repeatedly criticized for trying to rock the status quo Korea deal boat.
Right.
Just criticized. Leave it alone. It's good. You're going to upset everyone, this, that, and the other thing. And lo and behold, now that we actually got a very good deal for the American people, everybody who was saying don't do it, who was criticizing us, whether it's on Capitol Hill or in the business community or whatever, they're saying, hey, great job. And it is a great job, and it's going to save a lot of manufacturing jobs in the auto industry, in the steel industry. It's going to help in some of the cutting-edge industries like innovative pharmaceuticals. And it's all good.
Well, absolutely. Kudos to the president for changing the whole dynamic of how these trade deals are done, despite all the critics saying, oh, Donald Trump doesn't know anything about trade. I think he knows about business deals. But you've said these folks were going to be, if we left things the way they were, dumping light pickup trucks from Korea into the U.S. market. Now, if I take the terminology right, dumping means they'd be selling them either at or below cost or at a substantially reduced rate to make sure their civilian population in South Korea stays employed, even though it'll put a lot of Americans on the unemployment lines. Were they literally going to be dumping these trucks in the country?
So if you're a great chess player like President Trump is, he sees how the future might unfold and he makes appropriate moves to prevent bad things from happening. The bad thing that was going to happen, Lars, in this case was over the next 3 years, we were going to remove the 25% tariff on light trucks that was imposed on Korea. And basically, Korea was posed to just flood our markets. Now, this would have been particularly devastating, not so much to your area, but if you take a state like Michigan, the Ford F-Series is the most popular pickup truck in the world. That's made in, I think, Dearborn, Michigan. Then you have the Chevy Silverado in Flint, Michigan, the Dodge Ram, which is in Warren, Michigan. These are really good, high-paying jobs. There's a supply chain associated with them. And that those jobs were absolutely going to get hammered. And, of course, you know this, in communities where you lose these manufacturing jobs, you lose all the rest of the jobs, the lawyers, the accountants, the dry cleaners, all of that. Plus, you lose the tax base locally to pay for your police and fire and schools. And that's been the woe of America since 2001 when China joined the World Trade Organization, since 1994 since NAFTA hit us, and since 2012 since the Korea deal went. So, yes, this is a great thing. We were able to extend the defense of our light truck industry out to 2041, which is a long time. And in addition, on the free market side, Korea sells us 20 cars for every one we export to Korea. Now, what's the problem there? Well, they have quotas, strict quotas on how much we could sell them. But they also put on these things called non-tariff barriers, whereby we would make a car here in America with great safety standard equipment, very clean environmental pollution control equipment, ship that car to Korea. They would impose a second set of arbitrary standards for no other purpose than to raise the cost of that car by thousands of dollars and price it out of the market. So that's one of the big problems we had. And so we've gotten Korea to lower those non-tariff barriers, the NTBs we call them, and raise the quotas so that we can send them. So that was a great part of it. Now, another revolutionary part of this thing, this is one of the first agreements that has a side agreement on the whole problem of currency manipulation. Have you talked a lot about that on your show, Lars?
We've talked about it a bit, but I want to ask you a question because our time is limited and your time is limited. Tell me this. So the Korean government seems to acknowledge by all these barriers they put up that if Koreans, South Koreans, were given their druthers, they'd buy a whole lot more American cars unless these barriers are put up. So, you know, I understand. I'm not going to disparage. South Korean car companies make a good product. It's a good, solid product, and a lot of Americans like them. And they get to sell into one of the biggest markets, a market where almost everybody can afford to buy a car. And then we can't sell into their market freely. Are we going to get to the point where Koreans are just as free to buy an automobile from America as Americans are to buy one from South Korea?
Well, we think that President Trump's deal negotiated by Ambassador Robert Lighthizer will do just that. I mean, it's so pernicious the way some of our trading partners basically stick it to our auto industry.
No kidding.
Japan does the same thing. Like, Japan sells us 100 cars for every one we export to Japan. Japan actually has really low tariffs on autos, but they have these really, really high non-tariff barriers where they put on all these arbitrary standards, raise the cost. So, you send over a Ford Focus to compete with, I don't know, whether it be a Corolla or a Corona, and by the time the U.S. car has to meet the standards of Japan, it's like priced like a Lexus, so you don't sell any of them. It's crazy.
Well, we got to get this fixed. And, Peter, I want to congratulate you, and I want to congratulate the president. I'm only up against a break, but, Peter, thank you so much for taking the time with us. He is the assistant to the president and director of trade and industrial policy for the White House, Peter Navarro, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and I have to agree with Peter Navarro. I think that foreign dumping is dangerous to our country, and it's not equitable. The fact is, if South Korea was not getting this terrific deal from the United States, you wouldn't be selling nearly as many cars that are made in South Korea here in the United States. And I think that the South Koreans should have their choice. If they want to ignore all those locally made, Korean-made cars and buy an American car instead, they should be able to buy it on the same way that an American citizen can buy a Korean car. There shouldn't be any difference at all. That's what fair trade is all about. And that's, I think, where Donald Trump is getting us, despite the fact that he has to ignore all the nitwits who say, you don't know anything about trade. Why? You don't have any experience of that. Well, it's just plain business. How many of the people who've been telling us this isn't the way to do it are people who don't have any practical experience or very little practical experience in the real world the way Donald Trump does? Let's go to Sam on that note. Sam, you called in about China trade. What's on your mind today?
Yeah. Hi, Lars. It's great to meet you. My question is, if the United States controls the trades between China and the United States, then how come they haven't allowed the static generators to come into the United States? That would be a zero-cost electricity for households, businesses.
Hold on. Static generators? What are you referring to? I'm not familiar.
I'm referring to generators that run off of like antennas and pull static out of the air. They have them in China. They manufacture them in China. But the United States will not allow them to import them to the United States. Would that be by the doing of PGE, or are they running it?
Well,
then, the trade between China and the United States?
What is the fuel that fuels these static generators? Hello?
Air?
Air. Oh.
Electricity in the air?
I'm sorry, but I will look it's up and I will do some generator. Research on them, but at this point, Sam, I put static and generators that run on no fuel whatsoever, no power source whatsoever. I'm going to put in the same category as perpetual motion machines and things like that, because they don't exist. Now, if you can show me the science behind them works, and to your point about, corporate influence, if the big power generating companies of America thought they could buy generators that ran on nothing instead of running on natural gas, coal, nuclear power, hydroelectricity, They wouldn't be trying to keep them out. They would merely say, we are going to be the ones who buy the biggest ones, and we're going to supply electricity that way. So what you're telling me is all these supposedly smart companies that are in the business of electricity are ignoring a way to generate power without burning any fuel whatsoever. Persuade me why that's true.
Exactly, but I just took a trip to China and I actually went to their manufacturers that manufacture them and create them, and I had a word with them. I got to see them. I got to see them in action, and they are very much real, but from my understanding, the United States is trying to make money, and they just won't allow them in because there's zero cost.
Well, except that it doesn't make any sense that the folks who are in the electricity business wouldn't buy a zero-cost generator if one existed.
They wouldn't make any money off of the people of the United States.
Why wouldn't they?
They would charge it to install it.
You're starting with the premise that generator can
be installed, zero cost.
I understand. That's if everybody is willing to go out and spend the capital cost to buy them and then wire their own house up and take responsibility for it. I mean, take a look at Oregon and Washington. It's legal to go buy pot. You can grow your own, but many, many people buy something they could grow for free. And they don't do it because it's more convenient to do it the other way. But you still haven't persuaded me that the science is there. Doesn't it violate at least a couple of the laws of thermodynamics when you say, I'm going to generate electricity in large quantities, large enough to run a household, but with a generator that doesn't use any kind of fuel whatsoever, has no power source whatsoever?
Now think of it like this. You're walking around town, and all of a sudden, your hair is floating. That is static.
Yeah, and you know where it comes from? It comes from scraping my rubber-soled. It comes from scraping my rubber-soled shoes on the right kind of carpet or the right kind of flooring. Correct?
Yeah, that's static.
So if I could just get enough people to walk through my house all at the same time to generate enough static. And then how much do you measure? I mean, how much can you measure it if you say I'm generating what? 1/1,000,000th of a kilowatt? So you only have to have 1,000,000 people walking across the carpet in your living room to generate enough static to light your light bulbs?
Well, it's in the air. Can you measure the amount of static electricity in the air? No, you can't. So how can you really take that into measure?
Well, because again, if you had the ability to make this and the technology is solid, then there's no reason an American company wouldn't make it, because they sell gasoline-powered, propane-powered, natural gas-powered generators all day long. If a company said, there's this technology where we could sell a generator to people to put in their home, and many people do have generators at their home as backup power, but we can sell it for a fairly high price because it uses no fuel. It just pulls electricity out of the air, that were possible.
This is the last thing I got time for, and then I'm going to have to let you go. But I've seen it. Thousands of people have seen it. You can talk to more people around the United States, more people in China, more people in other countries that already know about it.
I'll tell you what,
future technology. We don't know what's coming, and it's coming fast.
If the Chinese have all this technology, why are they building one coal-fired power plant a month in China?
That beats me.
Well, maybe the Chinese don't even know what they have. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. For the life of me, I cannot figure out why the governments of this country are so antithetical to the idea of doing business. Now, yesterday we told you about Hardwick's Hardware, run by Dean Hardwick, a third generation. His son would like to be the fourth generation, but he's literally going to pack his bags and take his hardware store out of the place it's been since 1932. And why? Because he came under attack from government on taxes, on rules, on regulations. He says he's leaving the state within 18 months. And I don't think this is one of those hollow threats like the Hollywood actors are always throwing out. You know, if you elect Donald Trump, I'm leaving the country. You know, none of the Hollywood crowd ever left the country. But businesses do leave when you make things so uncomfortable that they can't do business anymore. Now, Hardwick's Hardware, kind of an old school business, but a great business. They sell hardware in the University District of Seattle. Let me give you an example from Central Oregon. And this one really ticks me off because it seems as though, as one of my friends says, dogs bark, ducks quack, and regulators regulate. Once you give somebody regulatory authority with no level of responsibility, they never have to explain, well, I'm doing this regulation and it's good for the community. Tell me how this is good for the community. In the city of Bend, there's a local skate shop. And the skate shop is called Sol Skates, spelled S-O-L-S-K-8-S, Sol Skates. Now, they sell skateboards, they sell decks, they sell wheels, they sell all that good stuff. Now, last time I was on a skateboard, long time ago. I have breakable bones at this age, so I'm not willing to get on a skateboard these days. But this guy is running a business, and he's running it in a semi-industrial area of town. So, he has a nice-looking shop. I've seen a picture of it. You know, from the outside, it would be a plus to any industrial area to have a nice looking building like that in a semi-industrial area. In fact, you can see right across the street, there's a bag house or some kind of collection area. You can tell it's a light industrial area. So he puts his skate shop there and the kids come down and they buy the skateboards, probably even people in their 40s. I don't want to say it's all kids. And he does a couple of things. He hangs a banner outside. Now, that's an inexpensive way to advertise. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give him some free advertising right now. The city of Bend comes along and says, take your signs down. He also has one of those A-frame signs, which is just, you know, boards put together so they look like an A. You put your sign on either side. People driving by say, hey, skate shop, let's stop and take a look. They tell him you have to take that down, too. Do you know what they're threatening him with right now? $148,500 in fines. $150,000 in fines for a place that sells skateboards because he put up a sign advertising his business. Now, what they say, he says, we barely make $750 in a week. $750 in a week. And he says, and here's the city saying, take your signs down. Stop advertising what you're offering up to the community. Then he says there, when he looked him up, which is what I tend to do as well, this guy, Andre Antonou, he looks in the city codes and says there's no codes to look up to find what you violated. It never said signs on buildings or banners on a fence. They got a copy of a letter from the city. Cites Bend Code 9.50.060, which includes a section that says, now get this, in a supposedly pro-business America, they say a business can put up one banner, total area, 60 square feet. So the sign could be 6 feet tall and 10 feet long, and that is all the bigger. And you can have one of them, and it may go up for only 60 days, and you have to get a permit and pay for it for the privilege of putting up a sign on your own business. He says he's taking those banners down because he doesn't want to get these $150,000 in fines, but then they went after him further. Now imagine this, Central Oregon, Bend, they get some snow. They get some inclement weather. It gets cold at certain times of the year. So on his property, in back of his shop, he put up a set of ramps. Well, imagine that. Your customers get a chance to go out and try out the skateboards the same way you test drive a car. He put up the ramps, but because it's inclement weather some parts of the year, he had a local garden outfit come by, and they put up what looks like the little greenhouse you see where you bend a piece of PVC pipe and then you put a piece of clear plastic over it, so that the customers for his store can take one of the skateboards out to a ramp that's not covered in snow, it's not frozen over in ice, you're not out in the wind and the weather and everything else during half of the year, and he put that up. And they said, take that down too. We want you to take that down. He has these little ramps in the back and seasonal covers to protect the ramps and skaters from the weather, and it's on his property. That's the part that's the most maddening for me. Like I said, I don't ride skateboards. Okay, I last did that when I was about 12, and they weren't like today's skateboards either. Believe me, metal wheels, not very flexible or anything else, and I'm not very flexible these days. But he says the cover over the skate area is not a building over the ramps. He said phone calls and trips to Ben's planning division haven't helped. We've reached out to this business. We've given them every chance to comply. They're not following the same rules as everyone else. They don't even know who's actually complained about this, if anyone has complained about it. The man is running a business, he's paying his taxes, he's employing people, he's selling a product, and it sounds to me like they're trying to put him out of business, or at least reduce his business. If that makes sense to any of you, please give me a call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Now, Mike, is calling because he heard us talking about the rental laws, the crazy ones in Seattle that have now been ruled unconstitutional by, of all people, a King County judge. Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind? Hey, Mike.
Hello. Yeah, hi. Hi.
Mike, what's on your mind, sir?
Yeah, you know, I have a couple of rental houses that I had purchased when I was about 17. And one of the things we've rented it out, and we've had some renters that have been great, and we've had some renters that haven't.
Right.
You know, I don't want somebody who has a dog because that ruins my house and all that, devalues it, and I have to do more work. But I've also had some people I couldn't get to pay my rent, so I actually kicked them out.
Yeah.
And gave it to somebody else because they were a liability for me. So,
right.
You know.
Okay. Mike, thanks very much for making that point. I'm not sure what the point was, but there we are. Brian's on the line in Bend. Brian, what do you think of the city of Bend going after this for-profit business, saying you can't advertise what you're doing, and you can't even put up a little bit of plastic to cover an area where your customers will try out these skateboards?
I think it's stupid. I live in Bend, and there is a tire shop or automotive shop on Empire Boulevard, and they have a full-size Jeep Wrangler with stickers on it sitting right on the sidewalk, right in front, and they allow that. I don't see what the problem is with allowing a small skate shop have a simple little, you know, $20, $30 sign out front. So I think that's pretty sad that they would do that to a small business or anything like that.
I do, too. Now, I understand that there are going to be people who say, well, we wrote these codes because sometimes a business will put up a whole bunch of banners. Well, that has a good effect and a bad effect. If it looks junky, that may actually work against getting customers in. And I know there are other people who say, well, it clutters up the area visually. Well, he's in a light industrial area. You don't I mean, Bend is full of pretty scenery, Mount Bachelor and the trees and the mountains and everything else. But in a light industrial area, there's plenty of ugly to go around. What the heck is wrong with putting up a couple of signs so people know this isn't a manufacturing site? It's a place that sells skateboards. Anyway, I'm looking forward to hearing from Andre Antonou if he calls in. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about a man who's making a great offer to mentor a youth on an antelope hunting trip. And that's a great thing. We're also going to talk about whether or not Portland police or any police are unfairly singling out black citizens for unfair attention from the police. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And one of my emailers actually noticed an interesting dichotomy. I love using a $5 word at least once a day. John Kitzhaber and his gal pal, Sylvia Hayes, managed to violate not quite a dozen different state ethics laws and earn or get $250,000 nearly by peddling influence out of the governor's office. The fine for Kitzhaber, $20,000. A shop to sell skateboards in Bend violates the sign code, and the city of Bend happily informs them that, unlike Governor Kitzhaber, they face $148,000 in fines. And don't even get me started on the cake shop and the $150,000 in fines there as well. Let's go to Christian. Hey, Christian, you wanted to comment on this whole situation. What's your take on the Bend skateboard shop that's facing 150 G's in fines for just putting up a banner to advertise their services?
Yeah, well, my take is that they're basically punishing the business because of the actions of the skateboarders themselves. I don't know if you ever noticed, but they tend to, you know, do tricks on anything elevated, or, you know, they call it grinding on, you know, platforms on school fronts. You sometimes see the polyurethane from the wheels left behind on concrete.
Oh, I've seen that, and I've seen the little metal strips they put on some concrete edges to try to discourage the skateboarders. And I don't approve of people damaging other folks' properties when they're, you know, having fun with a bike or with a skateboard. But why should you take that kind of stuff out on the guy who sells the product now, instead of the people who actually are doing the damage with their wheels?
Oh, I don't agree with it whatsoever. I think it's completely unfair. I mean, I can't come up with any rational explanation why they would be doing it other than punishing the business for the actions of the customer.
You know, maybe it'd be nice if we could get the mayor of Bend or one of the city council members. I'd be happy to take their calls and have them explain. So why is it you're going after this business? And if they tell me it's all about aesthetic appeal and keeping the area looking pretty, then ask them about the industrial area where the store is located. Again, industrial areas are not intended to be good looking, but they're going to do this instead and punish the guy behind the business. Maybe they can drive him out of business.
Do the right thing.
It's the right thing to do.
If you do, you could get Lars's props and kudos.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Well, I get some of these offers from time to time, and this is a great one because it involves introducing a young person to the joys of hunting, and I've told you how much I enjoy hunting, and I do. I love going hunting. I'd love to go on an antelope hunt one of these days, but this is for a deserving young person. I got this email from Joseph Ha. He says, Semper Fi. And by the way, Vietnam Veterans Recognition Day today. Thank you for your service, despite the bad treatment you got when you came home. He says, Lars, I'm looking for a good youth to mentor on an antelope hunting trip. I have enough points to apply for a good hunt. I'm working with an awesome guide, Gordon Conroy, with Broken Horn Outfitters, and I've hunted with him, and he is super supportive of veterans. I talked with Gordon. I will mentor a youth during the antelope season at no cost, including mounting of the antelope as well as all of the meat. I've saved my points. Now, listen to this. If you don't know what the points are, I accrue points as well. Every time you buy hunting license and tag, you're going to accrue some points. If you get enough points, you get a chance to go in and say, I'd like to get this tag or that tag. He said, I have saved my points for 13 years. I can now draw an awesome tag for some lucky youth to experience the harvest of an antelope. Broken Horn Outfitters is looking for some young people. They're in the veteran Lincoln as well. Let's see, as well as the outfitter willing to make this happen, please contact Gordon. If anybody knows a deserving youth who'd like to go out and try this, because hunting antelope would be an absolute thrill. I'd love to do it someday. I have not had the time. I have a lot of other things going on between work and family and everything else, but I would love some young person to be able to take up this offer from a generous veteran, and thank you for your service, and thank Gordon as well. If you want to get in touch with me, shoot me an email about this person. I will get you the contact information. I'll just shoot an email back and get it taken care of. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Neil's on the line. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, nice to talk to you. Now, I caught your show kind of late, just 15 or so minutes ago. I have an acre and a half east of downtown Portland. And within the last couple of years, put up a couple of carports.
Yeah.
Professionally built, ordered, installed by the people that install them.
Yeah.
Because I live under five giant fir trees that are constantly shedding branches during the windstorms.
Right.
And I've replaced a windshield on one car, dents in other cars, branches falling on power lines that go to my home, and breaking the guy wires that hold the power line to the trees. And I have a couple other things going there, too, but the city says I can't do that.
What's the reason?
Lars, I don't know that I totally understand it. They have their rules that say you can only park in certain places on your property. It's an acre and a half, as I said.
Yep.
It's an unpaved driveway that's graveled. And I had the carports put close to my home, in front of the front porch, 125 feet off the street.
Right.
And the city's all over me.
They're just telling you can't, and you, I guess these carports are temporary, right? Because I know that factors into a bunch of things where that you say, well, it's not a permanent structure, it's a temporary, or does it?
Yeah, well, I would assume they are temporary. They don't have a fountain, have walls. They're designed to protect the vehicle from weather, and in my case, tree branches.
Yeah, makes sense.
And then I have one other thing, and I'm sorry I don't have all my ducks in a row. I moved two camp trailers onto my property, same piece of property. Two people are living in them. Mm-hmm. The laws have recently loosened, related to that, and they're all over me about that as well.
And yet people need housing, and they're constantly saying, we have to find housing, and we'll let the bums violate the codes anytime they want. But apparently, if you're an actual property owner, you can't do that. And does that make sense to anybody? Brad's on in Battleground. Brad, you heard the story about the business in Bend that's facing $150,000 in fines simply because they put up some banners advertising their company. What do you say?
Amazing in itself. You know, these people in the taxpayers' buildings down in City Hall or wherever they are,
yep.
They've got to justify their jobs by doing something. Right or wrong, they're busy. And it's amazing. You know, if the tables were turned, these people would be up in arms, you know?
Yep.
But it's just ridiculous how overpowering it is.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, we've got to get rid of this anti-business attitude, especially now when people want jobs, people want economic activity. This anti-business attitude from government has to stop, or we have to replace the people in government. Coming up in a moment, there is a hue and cry saying the police are stopping too many black people. And we're going to get somebody to answer that in just a moment, one of our experts on law enforcement. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to tell you something that's going to make some of you feel uncomfortable, but that's why we call this Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. And here's what I want to tell you. There is a big to-do right now in most of the cities of the Northwest because the police arrest a lot of people of color. That is the, that's the phrase people use. And you say, well, that's not fair. They shouldn't arrest people of color any more than they arrest anyone else. Well, let's talk about the actual truth. Black citizens make up 12% of America's population, slightly lower in the Pacific Northwest. Black men make up about 6% of the U.S. population. But black men are, in the case of murder, responsible for 50% of all the murders in the United States. Now, that's not all black citizens, but it is certain black citizens. They commit 50% of all the murders. When it comes to violent crime and other kinds of crime, to use the kind of phrase that the college boys use, it is black citizens disproportionately commit crime compared to other racial groups in America. Those are the statistics. That's what happens. So then you get folks saying, including now it seems some in city government saying, we've got to fix this problem that too many black citizens are being stopped by the police. Too many are being arrested. Too many are being charged with crimes. Now, I think that's insane, because if you look at the numbers and say who's committing the crime, I made this comparison earlier. Do you know, I looked it up. It's almost 80%, but I'll call 75% to be safe. 75% of criminal acts in America are committed by men. Now, men are a minority in America. We're 49% of the population. Women are 51%. Can you imagine somebody coming out saying, we have to have true diversity here. Women should be arrested and charged with crimes just as often as men. Well, that either means arresting a whole lot of women for crimes they didn't commit and not arresting a whole lot of men for crimes they did commit. Does that make any sense to anybody? Anyway, I've invited Bernie Giusto, a retired Multnomah County sheriff, on to talk about this. Bernie, welcome back to the program. And what should we make of the fact that not just the city auditor, but even the police chief, Daniel Atlaw, is saying we have a problem and we have to gather more data and we have to make police officers do a whole lot more paperwork to prove that they're not unfairly stopping black citizens?
Well, I guess the city, Lars, can't decide where it is on this particular issue, because last year, in October, they decided to, the city as a whole, pushed by mayor and heavily supported by him, to do away with all the gang designations in the city, and especially those that were affiliate designations, and we can talk about that versus a gang member who's been convicted of a crime. But the city basically, no matter what you read about it, in my experience, they've wiped the slate clean, and now unless your crime is involved with a gun, you directly with a gun, some kind of violent crime, then it will go on another database when your name comes up. But if there are four or five people in the car and you're the only one involved in that particular arrest or whatever else, we're not going to keep track of that. And they started that in October of last year. Now we're right back to saying we don't have the right kind of information to figure out why it is that crime across the city, violent crime across the city, is starting to climb back up. And we're going to be right back into the same situation. Instead of, and this is, by the way, is not me saying this. This is the auditor saying that you need better documentation, not necessarily for the purpose of identifying people and gang members as gang members, but for identify people in terms of criminal trends in the city. And instead of the city going from a reasonable position and setting criteria by which they would create those databases based on a criminal activity or criminal association and allowing people to, for instance, appeal their name on that list, what happened in the first place, back before this happened in October, is that the city had a list that they kept, we'll just call it secret, with associate gang members on what it should have been, which should have been a public list. Let them put them on a public list and let somebody appeal that list in their name to have it taken off. And that is the way to protect from people being secretly held in a non-criminal matter. And that's important to understand between a criminal investigation and somebody who's keeping a book on people who are not committing criminal acts. But we need to track the activity of the city so that they can appeal and get it off.
See,
so the city can't have it both ways.
You know, Bernie, I'm not sure I agree with you. And let me tell you my objection. I'll tell you, a long time ago, I used to own ride-alongs and walk-alongs with the cops. These are walking beats. And one night, I was walking with a cop in a downtown area, and he said, "See that guy over in that corner over there?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "He's a new face around here, and we're not quite sure what he's up to, but, you know, he's hanging out with a bunch of the people who are dealing drugs and doing other kinds of vice." He says, "I want to find out who he is." So he waited until the guy jaywalked, and he stopped him for jaywalking. And then he did what they used to call a FIR, but that wasn't politically correct. FIR meant field interrogation report, and they thought that sounded too harsh, so they call it something else now. What do they call it now?
FIR.
And what he'd do is he'd ask a guy for ID. He'd say, "You were jaywalking there," which is a legitimate reason to stop him. He gets his name, he gets his age, his date of birth, and all that stuff, and he writes it in a little book. Now, why? Because later on, when somebody says, "Hey, that convenience store got robbed," well, who robbed it? Did anybody see the guy? "Yeah, I saw this guy running out." "Which guy?" "Well, it was, Tall Tony." And so he'd look in his book and go, "Oh, I know Tall Tony. He's the guy that I FIR'd 6 weeks ago. He's in my book." Now, do I think that should be made public? Probably not until Tall Tony has committed a crime, but it's good data to have as a cop so that when somebody says, "This tall guy named Tony," and you say, "I have no idea who that is, because I can't put that data together." But if he collects that book long enough, he's got information in there that helps him track down people responsible for rapes, robberies, assaults, and everything else. And if you were to make that public, I guarantee you, Bernie, the first thing that would happen is somebody would say, "I haven't committed any crime. Yes, I hang around downtown with a bunch of drug dealers and thieves and such, but I haven't committed a crime, and you're slandering me by putting me in this public database that anybody can look up." I could see that kind of lawsuit, and the ACLU would be happy to come in and sue the cops for doing it. On the other hand, I think it's smart for the cops to collect that kind of information, and it's stupid to tell them that they can't. So you stop a car, you arrest the driver because he's drunk, because he's committed a crime, he's carrying a gun, he pulled off a robbery, and there are four other people in the car who are clearly associated with him. Write their names down. If people want the police to be proactive, and they say, "Can't you keep some of these kids from getting involved in criminal gang activity?" Well, you have to know who they are first. Who are the kids hanging out with other gangs? And why would they get involved in this? Because they're egged on by the other gang members. "We shot this guy last week. You're going to shoot somebody this week, or you're going to rob something or steal from somewhere." And that gathering that data helps them solve the crime and might help you keep those kids out. Am I right?
Well, you're exactly right. And my comments, Lars, are backdropped against what is very liberal Oregon public records laws. And I'm going to tell you again, the way you describe it, it's never going to stand up. And here's why. Before this decision was made last year by the city, the police tried to hold those names back based on non-criminal ongoing investigations. The district attorney told them no way. They did in microscope look at the situation. It's in camera. Look at the situation and said, "No, you got to give those names up." So the what is you describe, I agree with in total. I grew up in an organization that was very aggressive that way. But the fact of the matter is, my comments are against what won't happen in Oregon based on our public records law. So there's got to be an in-between. And sometimes the best way to stop things is let people know their name's going on a public list.
Yeah, that's
and they're happy to get it off.
That's a point.
Because, again, let's take a look at what people can find out about you because of public records laws in the state. A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. So I just, again, the way you express it would be better in terms of police activity when it's done correctly, and that police don't, you know, we had that same situation back in the 70s when we were keeping non-criminal files on people who were in non-associate groups relative to peace marches and that kind of thing. And the court's been very clear across the United States about keeping non-criminal files on people. So while you and I come from a generation where we know it's more important to get ahead of it and trust police to be well run and policies to be balanced, we got to find an in-between fashion. But the city auditor said what you're doing now is totally ineffective. So basically the decision last year was not a good public policy decision. They're going to have to find a way to do something different.
Hey, Bernie, 1 minute on where are the most burglarized neighborhoods and what's happening to burglary in general, property crime?
I'll make that real quick. The city's under siege in terms of burglaries. Burglaries are up 11% citywide, and this is most of them residential burglaries. The areas of Hazelwood and Lance hit the hardest, but there is an area downtown Portland in the northwest neighborhood group that's getting hit hard. And basically, Lars, we've given up on property crimes in Multnomah County. That's number one. Number two, the juvenile justice system doesn't deal with burglary in terms of juveniles correctly. The victimization rates in those are predictable, and there's no political influence in those neighborhoods. In other words, they just don't have any voice downtown.
Bernie, I really appreciate your thoughts and insights. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. That's Bernie Giusto, the retired sheriff. I got to tell you something. This is insanity. When you start to tie the hands of the police, then you tie the hands of the school district, then you tie the hands of the courts, and then you say, let's decriminalize things like meth and heroin and cocaine, now decriminalized, at least in the state of Oregon. Thank God Washington State hasn't done it yet. Back in just a moment, it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, live on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with me. Tonight, I do my left hook, right jab thing with liberal lefty Steve Novick. We call it left hook, right jab. He has a hook, I have a jab, and there we go. We're going to talk about whether or not big companies like Facebook and others can share your personal data. I know my position is going to be when you give them permission to share your data, you can't very well turn around and say that we're not going to use the data. You already gave permission. You don't have the privacy. You gave it away for the cause. That's the payment that you made for your Facebook account, whether you like it or not. Now, I mentioned earlier that there's a nice gentleman who wrote to me, a vet, U.S. Marine Corps vet, who said he wanted to take a kid on an antelope hunt. He actually saved up his preference points so that he can get a really great tag on an antelope, take a kid hunting, no cost at all to the kid. And a gentleman just wrote to me, Kevin, in Lincoln City, and said, Lars, let's do something lasting for the young person's hunting career. How about buying the kid a rifle? And at first when I saw this, I thought, that's a great idea. I'll throw into that. And then I realized, it's impossible. Now, here's why it's impossible. The transfer laws. So if I've bought friends and family and some of my producers firearms, but I pay for them, they have to go get it. The kid, since he's a kid, can't go get it. He can't fill out the form 4473. It would have to be an adult in his home, and then the rifle would not be owned by the kid, it would be owned by the adult. This is the result of some of these crazy transfer laws. But if that happens, I'll be glad to throw in for that. Tina and I will throw in for that, and I'm glad for it. So tonight, in the 6 o'clock hour, I'll be doing left hook, right jab with Steve Novick. And usually they have a little poll during this thing, an online poll. And more often than not, I win. Sometimes I lose by a bit. But I think I'm going to win on this one because I think it's a little crazy to complain about loss of privacy when you signed your privacy away and said, I'd like a Facebook account. What does it cost? Why, just sign this form and give us your personal data. We'll give you the Facebook account or the Instagram account or the Twitter account for free. All of those companies sell your data. And then Facebook Zuckerberg runs around and says, we're going to protect the data. No, they're not. It's part of their business model. It is what they sell, in part, to make the money. Let's go to Anna in Clackamas. Hey, Anna, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. So take this with a grain of salt. I was 12 when 9/11 happened. And my understanding at the time was Homeland Security Act, they were going to start kind of recording phone calls and doing stuff like that for the sake of security and catching terrorists.
Yep.
And it was kind of like a patriotic thing. Okay. And then when Obama was in office, though, this stuff came out with the NSA, and the right was so opposed to this, and it was such an injustice that he was, you know, the government was recording data on these good, hardworking Americans. And now that Trump is in office again, I feel like, again, the conservatives are more in tune with giving up some of that liberty for the sake of security. So do you also feel like public opinion of this has changed with which party is in power, or am I just crazy and it's totally different between the three scenarios?
You're not crazy. And Anna, I tried to stay consistent on things. I've not changed my position on that. I think the data they were gathering at the time was what's called metadata, meaning the record that you made a phone, say if you called me, I don't know you that well, but if you called me on your cell phone and it was received on my cell phone, it would identify that this cell phone number called that cell phone number. And that was the day. They didn't collect the conversation or anything else. They said, if someday we have a situation like, do you remember the San Bernardino terrorists, the two jihadis that murdered all those people?
Right.
They stopped using that data 1 week before that shooting. Now, if they had had access to it, they could have said, let's find out, because both of them ended up dead. They were shot to death by the police. We'll find out who their cell phone, what cell phone numbers their cell phone is called, and then they could go two hops beyond that. So they could say, well, one of the jihadis, Tashfeen Malik and Syed Farouk. Oh, so Syed calls somebody else, and you find out who that person is. And then you find out who that person calls. You might have had some really valuable data. It's not available because now we've promised as a country we won't gather it. I haven't changed my position on that. I thought that was a valuable set of data, but we don't no longer use it. Okay, I accept that that's what it is. Do I think it would have been handy in finding the Austin bomber a couple of weeks ago? Yeah, I do, because he was carrying a cell phone around, and you probably could have found out exactly who he was much quicker if you'd been able to say, of those three bombings, we know roughly when the bombs were dropped off, whose cell phone was reaching out to towers in the area of that bomb at about the time it was dropped off. You could have done, you know, the Venn diagram thing we always thought was worthless in school would turn out to find, you know, they would have said, if you isolate all the people who were in the vicinity of where the bombs were dropped off during the hours when they were dropped off and had a cell phone turned on, I'll bet it would have been no more than a few people. So that's a quick answer to your question. And no, we're not giving up our privacy. I think Donald Trump's very concerned about his privacy, and so am I. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-439-5277. I know, we've said a lot over the last couple, 3 weeks about all the teenagers marching in the streets of Washington, D.C. Just a reminder, last Saturday's crowd in D.C. was 10% teenagers and 90% people about an average age of 49, according to the research. But what they were saying is, We want something done about guns in America. And, of course, that's easy to say. The hard thing to say is, what is it exactly you want done? So I got an email from Michael Sullivan, who I had written to a couple of years ago, literally 2 years ago, and said, I'd like to talk to you because he is a self-described person of liberal persuasion who decided to get into the Second Amendment side of things. And I was interested to hear his perspective. Given the nature of the events of the last 6 weeks or so, going back to the murders at Parkland, Florida, and at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High, I'm especially anxious to hear what he has to say about it. Michael, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm good. Did you say he?
I'm sorry, she. You're right.
yeah, there's no problem.
Mikhail.
No, it's just Michael. Michael.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, she now joins us to talk about her unique perspective on this. Are you still a liberal these days like you were a couple of years ago?
Well, I can't say that because it's unfair for you to call me a liberal when you do not know the full scope of my thinking.
No, I'm only asking for your self-description. You see, I always find that if you ask somebody if they're a conservative, and they are, they say, damn right, I'm a conservative, I'm a proud American conservative. But if you ask somebody if they're a liberal, they immediately try to start shedding the title as though they're ashamed of it. And it's always struck me as a strange circumstance that conservatives are always proud of being conservatives. Liberals usually tell me that they are ashamed, or they don't want anybody to put that label on them as though it's something bad. But how would you describe yourself politically?
Well, I would say that I have experienced a lot in my life to be sensitive to the needs of many people on various scopes of their journeys in this life. And so when you're doing reporting as a journalist and you're experiencing certain hardships with them as you report, it's very hard not to be sensitive about their situation. So when you want to call me a liberal, I may be liberal-minded in certain ways, and I might be conservative in others. It's unfortunate that the gun debate has only one label. If you are for guns, you are conservative. Mm-hmm. And if you are for gun control, you are liberal. But this is the division in this country.
Well, but can you tell me, that's a natural division to some extent, because can you tell me a prominent liberal who is pro-Second Amendment?
Well, I bought a gun 2 years ago because I needed to understand why people felt that guns made them feel safe, because I didn't really feel unsafe. And I thought perhaps I needed to understand it better by going in and buying a gun and learning how to shoot it. I've since taken another, I went to the gun range again, and I had it, and I had it and I shot my gun, and it became less volatile to me. It's just understanding it's a tool. Some people feel more secure with it. Some people feel that it's something to go shooting and enjoy as a recreational activity. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Now there's perversion somewhere in there that killing machines that were used at Parkland. Now, it seems that everything's getting clumped in there. And it's unfortunate because we need to respect things that we have access to by learning about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's where we are right now. It's a polarized, I don't want to know anything about it. I just know they're bad. And
well, hold up a second. Michael, when you say there are people who say I don't want to know anything about it, those of us on the pro-Second Amendment side know a lot about the subject, and I know most of the liberal arguments, and I know most of the against, and I know most of the conservative arguments for. So I want to get your perspective. When you see a couple of hundred thousand people marching in Washington, D.C. recently and protesting that something be done, and some of those young people and the adults that were backing them said, we want the repeal of the Second Amendment. We want strict gun controls. Some of them said, we want the entire civilian population disarmed. And I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, we live in a society that is based in fear right now, and not everybody is fearful. There are people who are terribly scared about not just guns, it's prosperity, quality of life, being treated because we're not, because we've been labeled as something that makes us different. I'm 6'1" and my name is Michael. You can imagine how I was teased and pulled out of the crowd because of just the way I look. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, at the end of the day, when a family member told me I need to get rid of my gun, and I didn't even have bullets for it. And I thought, well, why would you say that? Do you think I'm not capable of owning a gun without hurting someone? And then I wondered if that was a projection from that person's point of view, that if this person had a gun, that maybe a volatile reaction would happen because she had this gun. So now that is concerning to me because we are not experiencing things and learning about them by doing them. We are just seeing violence and saying, that's the key. That's the key. If we didn't have the guns, no one would get hurt. It's just not true.
No, it's not true. In fact, if you look at the statistics, hundreds of thousands of Americans every year use a pistol to protect themselves. And they often usually do not have to fire a single shot. They simply say, you're trying to assault me, I'm going to put a gun in your face, and the bad guy goes away. And that happens, right, according to the DOJ, hundreds of thousands of times every year. So
let me qualify that right now. when I was younger, I knew, had some students that I went to school with in 1998. And I was waiting tables. I was in the service industry. I had cash on hand. I thought they were coming to hang out. They were coming to steal stuff from me. Mm-hmm. And they put a sawed-off shotgun in my head in my apartment. You can get the police report in Atlanta back then, okay? Now, I was not scared of that gun in my face. In fact, I was more worried I wasn't able to pay rent, that I went after the guy with the sawed-off shotgun and put him in a headlock and threw him on the ground, and then he used the butt of the gun to hurt me and cocked down on the pavement. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, we keep talking about guns make you feel safe. Well, if you're braver than the person with the gun, maybe it's a non-issue. And so we saw this occur in Charlottesville.
Actually,
as well.
I don't agree with that, but because
that's
here's the thing.
Most
women are not 6 foot one. Most women are physically smaller than men, and an awful lot of criminals go out and deliberately pick a victim who is both physically smaller than them, and maybe their demeanor suggests that they are not as aggressive. An awful lot of criminals tend to be aggressive, and so you need something to equal up that equation. If the male weighs 225 pounds and is in reasonably good shape, and he's the criminal, and the victim weighs half of that and is a foot shorter, he's got an automatic advantage. How else would you equalize that situation to give the victim at least an equal chance to survive?
Well, she's not a victim until
soon to be victim, would be
see,
victim.
That's
whatever
another.
You want.
That's also another way to continue in the fear, right? Because if we're all walking around like someone's about to attack us, and despite my privilege, okay, I understand I'm privileged to be a big person. I get it. But if we do walk around in the mindset that we're scared all the time.
But Michael, I think you're mistaking something. I wear a seatbelt every single night when I drive my automobile. I haven't been in a serious car wreck that's hurt me ever in my life, but I wear that seatbelt. Now, if somebody made the ridiculous argument, Lars, you're wearing that seatbelt because you expect to crash your car on the way home, I'd say, no, you're an idiot. I'm wearing the seatbelt because it is a precautionary move against the possibility of an accident, which I realize is relatively small.
Okay, that's fair for you to feel that way about putting on the seatbelt, but I do know that sometimes I put a seatbelt on because I don't want to get pulled over.
Well, and maybe you do that. Michael, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, and I appreciate your perspective. We'll be back in just a moment. I want to get to your phone calls and your emails, and there is a lot to talk about today. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. Do you know the Northwest is now being used by the Attorney General of the United States to highlight one of the problems, a dual problem, no border wall and lots of heroin coming past that no border wall situation? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our Twitter poll today brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right online at ultimatetruckservice.com. Here's the issue, and it was decided by a judge in Seattle yesterday. Believe it or not, a King County Superior Court judge decided that the city of Seattle had violated the Constitution when the city of Seattle came down with a rule that said if you're a landlord and you're renting housing, you're renting a house or an apartment or a condo, that you don't have the right to choose which tenant lives in the property. You must take the very first person who walks through the door and says, I would like to rent this place. You can't say, well, I'd like to hear or see all of the applicants. You can't choose. Well, even a liberal judge in King County had to decide that was a violation of constitutional rights. And so our Twitter poll today, should landlords be allowed to choose which tenants live in their properties? Yesterday's Twitter poll, should the police keep a list of identified gang members? 95% of you said yes, 5% said no, and City Hall says no, we're not going to let the police do that, even though arguably it's one of the best ways to be proactive about maybe saving a young man, it's usually a young man, not a young woman, from a life of crime like that. John Kitzhaber is on the agenda as well. The former governor of Oregon who committed ethics violations of the law and could have faced $50,000 in fines got a 60% discount from his friends, the Democrats, who run the state government. And they said, oh, John, you only have to pay 20. And he still gets his PERS pension, So he's doing okay, although his girlfriend now has a $125,000 lien against her house because she tried to fight giving up some public records. They were emails, and she lost. And she lost badly enough that attorney's fees were awarded to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go to Freddie, first of all. Freddie, I take it you called in because of Initiative Petition 43, the gun-grabbing initiative petition that folks like Michael Bloomberg hope to get on the ballot in Oregon. What's your question or comment?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Lars.
You bet.
So, first of all, my concern is there going to be, if this Initiative 43 passes, will there be a door-to-door confiscation on firearms? And follow-up to that is, if that is, in fact, true that that could happen if this passes, do you foresee or are you concerned about any kind of social unrest or people unwilling to just surrender their firearms? I mean,
well, is it possible for it to happen? Yes. Is it likely to happen? No. Do you know what I think they're going to do? They're going to do the same thing the state of New York did just a couple, 3 years ago. The state of New York passed a ban that was very similar. You said you couldn't possess it, you couldn't buy them, you couldn't sell them, et cetera, and give them up. And the estimate at the time, there was about 1 million firearms in New York State that were covered by that law. To my knowledge, very few people complied with the law. And the state has not sent the state police around door to door trying to collect those. In other words, it's a sort of a don't ask, don't tell. If you have them, you're technically in violation of the law, but the cops aren't going to come looking for them. If they find them inadvertently, you're likely to be charged. But in the meantime, it's one more law on the books that they don't want to enforce. Nor do I think the law should be on the books, but I think it's abundantly foolish to put a law on the books and say, but we're going to put the law on and then not enforce it. Could they go door to door and demand you surrender? Yeah, they could. They could. But are they likely to? No. I think they will. Here's what will happen. You pay your taxes to the IRS every year?
Yes, sir.
Ever been tempted not to?
No, sir.
Know what happens if you don't pay your taxes?
You go to federal prison.
Yeah, at some point they'll show up at your house and say, you got to give us all your stuff. I mean, that's why I always say taxes are collected at the point of a gun, because people say, well, that's not true. I say, yeah, it is. Try not paying your taxes for a couple of years. The IRS will send the local sheriff's department to your door and they'll say, we're seizing your car and your other property to satisfy your tax debt. And if you have failed to, you know, if you've actually violated the law and you're subject to criminal sanctions, you're going to prison. So, you know, that's what I think they plan to do is they will plan to pass this law, then they will make a few example cases, because, boy, when there's an IRS case and somebody, you know, a Wesley Snipes or something, he got in tax trouble and he went to prison. They will make a few example cases like that in the hopes that everybody else will look at that and say, I don't want to end up like him. And those people will either sell their guns or give their guns away or let the police destroy them. And they will enforce it that way. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And I appreciate the call. No, that's exactly.
Are you kidding me?
You gotta be kidding me.
You gotta be kidding me.
You must be joking.
No, really, it's true.
Now, here's Lars with today's Are You Kidding Me moment.
Actually, this is one of those Are You Kidding Me's where I was glad to see it happen. The Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, is using the Pacific Northwest as a bad example. He's pointed to the seizure of black tar heroin and a huge group of people. Indictments returned against 22 different people in 24 locations in four different states. This group was bringing in, they say, 10 pounds of Mexican tar heroin into the Portland area every week at the peak, according to Billy Williams, the U.S. Attorney for Oregon. And here's what Jeff Sessions has said. He has said that because of our porous southern border, traffickers from Nayarit, like these defendants, have become notorious across the United States for their effectiveness in dispensing cheap and powerful heroin. We will never know the full extent of the consequences of their actions. I'll remind you of one thing. Heroin comes into the United States. The DEA says more than 90% of it comes from south of our border, that one entry location. And I'll tell you that last year, more than 60,000 people died from overdoses from heroin. and most of it from street drugs, not from pharmaceuticals. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, and I want to remind you, tonight I'm doing Left Hook or Right Jab, my weekly debate with the liberal Steve Novick on Channel 8, KGW Television. In the 6 o'clock news hour, we're going to be debating whether or not big companies like Facebook can use your private information that I would point out has gone public because you've decided to make it public by giving them permission to use it. But I want to tell you about a big development that literally just came down in the last few minutes. Attorney General Jeff Sessions sent a letter to lawmakers today. He has declined to name a second special counsel to investigate allegations of surveillance abuse within the Justice Department, despite pressure from the Republican Party for him to do so. Now, I think he's got another plan, and here's why. He says in the letter, to justify such an appointment of a second counsel, the attorney general would need to conclude that the public interest would be served by removing a large degree of responsibility for the matter from the Department of Justice. Although folks have pointed out that in this case, if the Department of Justice investigates the allegations, and these include that information was abused within the Justice Department, it would be effectively the Justice Department investigating itself. He goes on to say in the letter that he has named federal prosecutor John Huber to lead the investigation into the Republican allegations that the FBI abused a surveillance program against a former Trump campaign advisor. That would be Carter Page in this case, who was wiretapped by the FBI. The wiretap justified by the so-called Steele dossier, which was itself a product of collusion between Russian government agents, former British spy Christopher Steele, and the Democrat National Party and Hillary Clinton. So he's put Huber in charge of that. Huber is also looking at, get this, and this is good news, whether the FBI should have been more thorough in probing Hillary Clinton's ties to Uranium One, the Russian nuclear energy agency. By the way, Huber was appointed to his position 3 years ago by none other than Barack Obama. Now, he could still be an honorable guy, but it concerns me a little bit that we have people investigating whether or not Democrats like Hillary Clinton and her former boss Barack Obama committed crimes, and the guy doing the investigation was appointed by the guy he's going to have to investigate. Because remember, almost anything that Hillary Clinton did as Secretary of State, and she signed off on the Uranium One deal as Secretary of State, she was at the time the Secretary of State for Barack Obama. And did the former president know what was going on within the State Department? And did he sign off on it? I want to go to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Ron in Beaverton. Ron, you heard me talking about that crazy Seattle rule that said that a landlord had to rent to the very first tenant who walked in the door. What do you think of that?
So my question is, how is that law set up? I mean, is it the first person that actually passes their background check and the application, or just who walks in the door?
As I understand the way they wrote the rule, you're a landlord, and I know that sometimes you're contacted by tenants by phone or by email or by an in-person visit. The first person who contacts you and says, I want the apartment, and offers to pay the rent, that person has to be given it. Now, I assume that you as a landlord could say, fine, you've got it. We now run the background check, and if you come up with a down check, then we can turn you down. But I also expect that because they had planned to enforce this law because they think that landlords are a pack of bigots who say, oh, I'm not renting to somebody who's black, I'm not renting to somebody who's Hispanic, I'm not renting to somebody who's gay, that I would imagine they would do investigations just as they have to say, so you turned this guy down. Why? Well, he failed the credit check. Well, let's see the reply that you got back from the credit check company. We're going to double check that to see if you're actually telling the truth. In other words, this was a window that the city of Seattle, in its craziness, tried to open into your business so that you'll be double checked by them. And if you say my criteria is I don't rent to anybody with a credit score lower than 600, I imagine they would say to you, well, that's not right, because an awful lot of black Americans have credit scores below 600 and fewer white Americans have credit scores below 600. So therefore, you've set up an automatically racist method for determining who to rent to. I mean, I can, having covered governments for a long time, that's exactly the direction they would go. They would try to prove that you are doing de facto racist treatment of your potential tenants by saying you've set the criteria so that you can turn down all the prospective black tenants and give the apartments to white people instead. That makes sense, Ron?
I can agree with that. I'm still here. I can agree with that. The thing is, though, I guess the application type stuff, they should be able to say, yeah, sure, you can, we'll rent to the first person, but after you, there's a specific application that you have to fill out.
Well, it's the choice of the landlord. Who, you know, a landlord could rent you on an application written on a cocktail napkin if he wants to. It's his choice. But most landlords use a standardized form that asks a bunch of standard questions. And I get that. You'd still be allowed to do that. But if the person was the first person in the door and they met the criteria and could pay the rent, you have to rent to them. That has now been ruled unconstitutional by a King County judge. Let's go to Elias if he's listening. Elias, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How are you?
Hey, Lars, how's it going?
Not too bad. What's on your mind?
I got a pretty big conspiracy today.
Go for it.
Conspiracy theory. So Michael Bloomberg and these globalist elites understand that in order to achieve their agenda of globalization and a one-world currency and a one-world government, they have to destabilize America. And the only thing that will truly destabilize this country is a civil war. And the only thing that would cause a civil war is the gun issue. When they start kicking in doors, coming for our guns, that's when the Civil War will kick off. Destabilize the economy, destabilize the global economy, and then give them, position them in the position to achieve their overall agenda, which
is a good conspiracy theory, because you have to assume that you'll get local governments, especially local governments, because they're on the front lines when it comes to law enforcement, to actually do the kind of really offensive, objectionable enforcement of that law to force people to start to act illegally. Can we agree on that?
Well, absolutely, and they wouldn't. Most of them would not do that. I know them a lot. I shoot with them in competition shooting. These guys are not going to do that, but there is a percentage of them that will do it.
No, but But Elias, I'm not talking about the folks who are having their guns taken away. I'm talking about the local government. Do you think the likes of the mayor of Seattle, mayor of Portland, mayor of Spokane are going to tell their police force, you get out there, you go door to door, and you start striking up confrontations between you and citizens, assuming this initiative petition 43 passes? Do you think they'll do that? Because I think their police...
I think there will be a percentage of them that'll do it, Lars. I think most of them will not. And they will break away from, you know, the standard, you know, police force. And that's where the conflict will come from. It'll come from the tier one operators like the Navy SEALs and the Delta Force operators that will never stand up for any of this, and the sheriff's office that will break away. But then they'll have factions of the state police and whatnot, and it'll destabilize the country, and it'll divide us, and it possibly will cause a civil war.
It could. Elias, it's a great theory. By the way, I want to give you an alert, because the latest data breach is in your drawers. I'm not joking. This just came down a moment ago, and this is not a joke, although it is kind of, it's a little funny, the company it's affecting, Under Armour, which makes skivvies and T-shirts, right? They have just announced a data breach affecting 150 million MyFitnessPal app accounts. In other words, 150 million people, those must be the people who look good in their underwear. I don't look good in my underwear. I just take my word for it. You won't find any pictures because I don't take those kind of pictures. But if you look good in your underwear and you decide I'm going to be one of those fitness guys and I'm going to download the app, Under Armour is now saying they have announced that data tied to its fitness app and website was breached earlier this year. The stolen information includes usernames and email addresses. So watch out, because they're even hacking into your underwear. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I certainly hope with that development of the Attorney General announcing that he is not going to announce a brand new special prosecutor to go after some of Hillary Clinton's crimes, including Uranium One and use of information, all that. If he's not going to do that, I hope the DOJ goes after this hammer and tong. They need to make sure that somebody pays the penalty for the kinds of violations of the law that were committed there.
I am an illegal alien.
They use your health care, drive on your roads, use your schools, and take your jobs.
My fellow Americans and our millions of illegal aliens.
It's time for Lars's Illegal Play of the Day.
You know, every single week, ordinary citizen David Cross invests his time and his efforts in coming up with a criminal illegal alien of the Week Report. David, welcome back to the program. Who are you going to feature today?
Lars, this week we're going to touch base on what you wanted to know last week. Down near Deschutes County, the Oregon State Police stopped a pickup driven by Israel Salvador Mercado Mendoza, age 31, of Creswell, Oregon, and Rigoberto Morfin Pedroza, age 33, of Los Angeles, California. You wanted to know if these guys were illegally in the country. Both of them are illegally in the country, and they're Mexican nationals. And they were caught with 74 pounds of methamphetamine. Lars, but what I really thought was interesting about the story, and I know you'll notice this, instead of being packed in kilos, they were packed in one-pound packages. Isn't that kind of interesting?
That's nice because they've converted from the metric system to the English system for carrying their dope. But I want to remind people, you know, who don't use meth, like I don't use meth, this is 74 pounds of something that is sold in grams and fractions of a gram. 28 grams to the ounce, 16 ounces to the pound, 74 pounds on board with these two Mexican national illegal aliens transporting a massive quantity of drugs into the United States in just one trip.
Well, I have a sense, Lars, that they repackaged those drugs in this country to distribute them in this country, converting from obviously the metric system to the pound system. What was also interesting is the Douglas Interagency narcotics team took these guys down, and it's interesting. They said that if that drugs were sold in 1 pound quantities, the overall drugs would be worth $370,000. That's a huge amount of drugs. And I just want to thank Marissa Cartel for the ICE spokesperson for helping us get this information.
Yeah, I'm glad for it too, because when we saw those, I mean, look, every time I see an arrest involving someone with a Hispanic surname, I know there's better than an even chance that that person is not in this country legally. And I've always made the case that if you're already breaking a country's laws, then breaking a few more is not that big a deal. Those of us who are law-abiding, think about breaking a law as being something that would be tremendously devastating. But if you're somebody who's here illegally, and they might pick you up and give you a free trip back to your home country, whether it's Mexico or Guatemala, that's kind of the cost of doing business. I appreciate the call, David, and thanks a lot for the update. Let me go to Ron in Olympia, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. How you doing, Ron?
Pretty good. How about you, Lars?
Not so bad. I just got word that apparently the 420 crowd just lost their Second Amendment fight. They were angry because you can't buy a firearm if you admit to being a marijuana user, even when it's legal in your state. And it sounds as though they just lost that case before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that's always overturned. The lawsuit came from a woman in Nevada who said she tried to buy a firearm after getting a medical marijuana card, and the store said, no, you can't, because there's a federal rule against selling guns to people who use pot, even if you're using it legally. So what's on your mind today?
Well, very interesting. I'm just wondering, Lars, how many of the senators and congressmen have gotten phone calls from the public asking them directly, do you have a firearm in your house? Are you a possessor of a firearm? None of these people have been called out that I'm aware of. I'd sure like to know who those people are.
Yeah, I would too.
What do you think?
I would too, although here's the other thing. I try to be reasonable. I'm a reasonable conservative. If somebody calls and says, do you have guns in your home, that is a security-related question. It's like saying, do you lock your back door at night, or do you have a security system or an alarm system or floodlights in your backyard? It's all related to security. So I could see some of them saying, we don't give that information out, whether they're liberals or conservatives. But I do know that there are a great many liberals, especially people in high positions, whether it's in entertainment or music or politics, who are guarded by men and women with guns, even while they're protesting against guns. That was certainly the case last Saturday in Washington, D.C. Whole bunch of people protesting against guns, protected by people, both, you know, private security and by the police, who are armed, which is seems kind of ironic to me.
Yeah, very much so. I hope this thing gets worked out. I just can only suspect that it's going to get worse if the midterms don't go right. And I got to tell you, it's a big fear of mine, and I don't know a whole lot of people that are going along with what the Democrats are pulling there.
No, but you know what would be nice? Here would be a great statement. They already have a bill for nationwide reciprocity. It already has enough votes to pass the House. I would think if you want to send a strong message that conservatives are actually still conservative, the Senate would pass that bill right now, put it on Donald Trump's desk and say, there, that's the law of the land. And they would invite their Democrat friends to vote against it if they want to. By the way, left hook, right jab tonight on Channel 8 in the 6 o'clock hour. Emails are welcome. Talk at LarsLarson.com.